How did you do it?
I'd take a piece of clothing or a toy that belonged to the child. Then I'd go for a walk with the cops, trying to retrace the last few minutes where he was seen,
Serenity says.
And sometimes I'd get something.
Like?
A flash in my head of a street sign or type of landscape, or a make of car, or even once a goldfish bowl that turned out to be in the room where the kid was being locked up. But
she shifts uneasily.
My psychic arteries may have hardened a little bit.
I don't know how a psychic could ever lose if, as Serenity says, the information she gets might be a direct hit or might actually mean the exact opposite. It seems to me like the biggest career safety net ever. And yeah, maybe the elephant Serenity pictured is some metaphor for a huge obstacle my mother's faced. But as Freud would probably say, maybe it's really an elephant. There's only one way to find out. You have a car, right?
Yeah. What? Why?
I walk across the living room, wrapping my mother's scarf around my neck. Then I reach into one of the drawers I'd searched through when I first arrived, in which I'd seen a jangle of car keys. I toss them to Serenity and walk out the door of her apartment. I may not be psychic, but I know this much. She's too curious about what that dream means not to follow. Serenity drives a yellow VW Bug from the 1980s that has rusted through in a lacy pattern behind the passenger door. My bike is pretzeled into the back seat. I direct her on back roads and state highways, getting lost only twice, because you can cut through alleyways on a bike that you can't cut through with a car. When we get to the Stark Nature Preserve, we are the only car parked in the lot.
Now are you going to tell me why you dragged me here?
She asks. This used to be an elephant sanctuary, I tell her. She looks out the window as if she expects to still see one.
Here? In New Hampshire?
I nod. My dad was an animal behaviorist. He started the place before he met my mom. Everyone thinks about elephants living in super hot places like Thailand and Africa, but they can adapt really well to cold and even snow. When I was born, he had 7 elephants here that he'd rescued from zoos and circuses.
Where are they now?
The elephant sanctuary in Tennessee took them all when this place shut down. I look at the chain gate across the trailhead. The land was sold back to the state. I was too little to remember when it happened. I open the passenger door and get out of the car, glancing back to make sure that Serenity is following me. We have to walk the rest of the way. Serenity looks down at her leopard print flip-flops and then at the overgrown trail.
Where?
You tell me. It takes Serenity a moment to understand what I'm asking her to do.
Oh, no,
she says.
Hell no.
She pivots on her heel and starts back to the car. I grab her arm. You told me you haven't had a dream in years, but you dreamed about my mom. It's not going to hurt to see if you get a flash of something, is it?
10 years isn't a cold case. It's an ice trail. There's nothing still here now that existed back when your mother disappeared.
I'm here, I say. Serenity's nostrils flare. I know the last thing you want is to prove that your dream didn't really mean anything at all, I say. But it's kind of like winning the lottery, right? If you don't buy a ticket, you never even have a chance.
I buy a goddamn ticket every week and I've never won the Powerball,
Serenity mutters. But she steps over the chain and starts bushwhacking through the overgrown trail. We walk in silence for a while as insects zip past our heads and summer hums around us. Serenity walks with her hand brushing the brows. At one point, she breaks off a leaf and sniffs it before moving on. What are we looking for? I whisper.
I'll tell you when I know.
It's just that we're practically off the grounds of the old sanctuary.
Do you or do you not want me to concentrate? Serenity interrupts.
So I'm quiet for a few more minutes. But there's something that's been nagging at me for the whole car ride. It feels like a bone caught at the back of my throat. Serenity, I ask. If my mother wasn't alive and you knew that, would you lie to me and tell me she was? She stops and turns, hands on her hips.
Sugar, I don't know you well enough to like you, much less protect your tender little teenage heart. I don't know why your mother isn't coming through to me. It could be because she's alive, not dead. Or it could be, like I said, because I'm rusty. But I promise you, if I get any sense that your mother's a spirit or even a ghost, I'll tell you the truth.
A spirit or a ghost?
They're two different things. You can thank Hollywood for making everyone think they're one and the same.
She looks over her shoulder at me.
When the body expires, it's over. Done. Elvis has left the building. But the soul is still intact. If you've led a decent life and you don't have a lot of regrets, you may hang around for a bit, but sooner or later you'll finish the transition.
Transition?
Crossover. Go to heaven. Whatever you want to call it. If you go through that process, you become a spirit. But let's say you've been a jerk in this lifetime, and St. Peter or Jesus or Allah is going to judge your sorry ass, and you'll probably go to hell or some other bad real estate in the afterlife. Or maybe you're angry that you died young. Or hell, maybe you don't even realize you're dead at all. For any one of those reasons, you might decide you aren't quite ready to leave this world, or be dead yet. The problem is, you are dead. There's no way around that. So you stay here in limbo as a ghost.
We are walking again, side by side through the thick brush. So if my mother's a spirit, she's gone somewhere else?
That's right.
And if she's a ghost, where is she?
Here. She's part of this world, but not the same part you're in.
Serenity shakes her head.
How do I explain this?
She mutters and snaps her fingers.
I once saw a documentary about Disney animators. There are all these transparent layers with different lines and colors that stack on top of each other to make a single Donald Duck or Goofy. I think it's like that for ghosts. They're another layer laid over our own world.
How do you know all this? I ask.
It's just what I've been told, Serenity says. It's the tip of the iceberg from what I can tell.
I glance around trying to see all these ghosts that must be hovering at the edges of my peripheral vision, trying to feel my mother. Maybe it wouldn't be all that bad if she was dead but still somewhere close by. Would I know it if she was a ghost and she tried to talk to me?
You ever hear the phone ring and pick it up and just get dead air? That could be a spirit trying to tell you something. Their energy. So the easiest way for them to try to get your attention is by manipulating energy. Phone lines, computer glitches, turning lights on and off.
Is that how they communicate with you?
She hesitates. For me, it's more like when I first tried contact lenses. I could never adjust because I could tell there was something foreign in my eye that didn't belong. It wasn't uncomfortable, it just wasn't part of me. That's how it feels when I get information from the other side. Like an afterthought, except I'm not the one who's thought it.
Kind of like you can't help but hear it, I ask. Like a song you can't stop humming?
I guess so.
I used to think I saw my mom all the time, I say softly. I'd be in a crowded place, and I'd let go of my grandma's hand and start running toward her, but I was never able to catch up. Serenity is staring at me with a strange look on her face.
Maybe you are psychic.
Or maybe missing someone and finding someone have the same symptoms, I say. Suddenly she stops walking.
I'm feeling something,
she says dramatically. I look around, but all I see is a small hummock of tall grass, a few trees, and a delicate mobile of monarch butterflies turning slowly overhead. We're nowhere near a sugar maple, I point out.
Visions are like metaphors,
Serenity explains.
Which is pretty ironic because that's a simile, I say.
What?
Never mind. I pull the blue scarf off my neck. Wouldn't it help if you held this? I pass it to her, but she rears away like it's going to give her the plague. The thing is, I've already let go of it,
and a gust of wind carries it skyward, a tiny tornado spiraling further and further away. No! I scream. And like a shot, I run after it. It dips and rises, teasing me, caught on air currents, but never coming close enough for me to catch. After a few minutes, the scarf gets tangled in the branches of a tree, about 20 feet up. I find a foothold and try to shimmy up the tree, but there are no knots on the bark for toeholds. Frustrated, I fall down hard on the ground, tears stinging my eyes. There's so little I have of her. Here. I find Serenity crouched beside me, her hands laced together to give me a leg up. I scratch my cheek and my arms as I climb. My fingernails break as I dig them into the bark, but I manage to get high enough to reach the first notch made by a branch. I scrabble around with my hand and feel dirt and twigs, the abandoned nest of an enterprising bird. The scarf is caught on something. I pull, finally tugging it free. Leaves and sticks rain down on me, on Serenity. And something more substantial smacks me on the forehead as it falls to the ground. What the hell is that? I ask, as I wrap my mother's scarf around my neck again and tie it tightly. Serenity stares down at her palms, astounded. She hands me the thing that fell. It's a cracked black leather wallet with its contents still intact. $33. An old-style MasterCard with those Venn diagram circles. And a New Hampshire driver's license issued to Alice K. Metcalf. It is evidence. Real, honest-to-God evidence. And it's burning a hole in the pocket of my shorts. With this, I can prove that my mother's disappearance might not have been of her own free will. How far could she have gone without any money or credit cards? Do you know what this means? I ask Serenity, who's gotten very quiet now that we've hiked back to her car and started driving into town. The police can try to find her. Serenity glances at me. It's been 10 years. It's not as easy as that. Yes, it is. New evidence equals a reopened case. Bam! You think that's what you want, she says. But you may be surprised. Are you kidding me? This is what I've dreamed of for, well, as long as I can remember. She purses her lips. Every time I used to ask my spirit guides questions about what it was like in their world, they'd make it clear there were some things I wasn't supposed to know. I thought it was to protect some big cosmic secret about the afterlife. But eventually I realized it was to protect me. If I don't try to find her, I tell her, then I'll spend my whole life wondering what would have happened if I did. She stops at a red light. And if you find her? When, I correct. When you find her, Serenity says. Are you going to ask her why she didn't come looking for you all these years? I don't answer, and she turns away. All I'm saying is if you want answers, you better be ready to hear them. I realize that she's driving right past the police station. Hey, stop! I cry out, and she slams on the brakes. We have to go in there and tell them what we found. Serenity pulls over to the curb. We don't have to do anything. I reported my vision to you. I even drove you all the way to that state park, and I'm happy you got what you wanted. But I personally do not need or want to become involved with the police. So that's it, I say, stunned. You throw information into someone else's life like a grenade, and you walk away before it explodes? Don't shoot the messenger. I don't know why I'm surprised. I don't know Serenity Jones at all, and I shouldn't expect her to help me. But I'm sick and tired of people in my life abandoning me, and she will be just one more. So I do what is easiest when I feel like I'm in danger of being left behind. I make sure I'm the one to walk away first. No wonder people hated you, I say. At that, her head snaps up. Thanks for the vision. I get out of the car, untangling my bike from the back seat. Have a nice life.
I slam the door shut, park my bike, and walk up the granite steps of the police station. I approach the dispatcher inside the glass booth. She's maybe a few years older than me, a recent high school grad, and she's wearing a shapeless polo shirt with a police logo on the chest and too much black eyeliner. On the computer screen behind her, I can see that she's been checking her Facebook page. I clear my throat, which I know she can hear since there's a little grid in the glass that separates us. "Hello?" I say, but she keeps typing. I knock on the glass and her eyes flicker toward mine. I wave to get her attention. The phone rings and she turns away from me as if I don't matter at all and takes the call instead. I swear, it's kids like her who are giving my generation a really bad reputation. A second dispatcher walks toward me. She's a squat, older woman, shaped like an apple, with a frizzy blonde perm. She has a name tag, Polly.
"Can I help you?"
"Yes," I say, offering my most mature smile, because really, what adult is going to take a 13-year-old girl seriously when she says she wants to report a disappearance that happened a decade ago?
"I'd like to talk to a detective."
"What's this about?"
"It's kind of complicated," I say. 10 years ago, an employee was killed at the old elephant sanctuary, and Virgil Stanhope was investigating it, and I really need to talk to him directly. Polly purses her lips.
"What's your name, sweetheart?"
"Jenna. Jenna Metcalf." She takes off her head mic and walks into a back room I cannot see. I scour the wall of missing people and deadbeat dads. If my mother's face had been plastered up there 10 years ago, would I even be standing here now? Polly reappears on my side of the glass wall, entering through a doorway that has a push-button combination lock on its knob. She leads me to a bank of chairs and sits me down.
"I remember that case,"
she says to me. "So you know Detective Stanhope? I realize he's not working here anymore, but I thought you may be able to tell me where he is now."
"I'm not sure how you're going to get in touch with him."
Polly puts her hand gently on my arm.
"Virgil Stanhope is dead."
The residential facility where my father has lived since everything happened is only 3 miles from my grandmother's home, but I don't go there very often. It's depressing because it, A, always smells like pee, and B, has cutouts of snowflakes or fireworks or jack-o'-lanterns taped to the windows as if the building houses kindergartners rather than the mentally ill. The facility is called Hartwick House, which makes me think of a PBS drama and not the sad reality of super-drugged zombies watching the Food Network in the main lounge as aides bring around tiny cups of pills to keep them placid, or sandbag patients draped slack over the arms of wheelchairs as they sleep off ECT treatments. Most of the time when I go there, I don't feel scared, just hideously depressed to think that my dad, who used to be seen in conservation circles as something of a savior, couldn't manage to save himself. Only once have I been really freaked out at Hartwick House. I was playing checkers with my dad in the lounge when a teenage girl with greasy ropes of hair burst through the double doors holding a kitchen knife. I have no idea where she got it. Anything that could be considered a weapon, even shoelaces, is forbidden at Hartwick House, or kept in cabinets with more security than Rikers Island. But anyway, she outsmarted the system, and she came through the double doors with her crazy gaze locked right on my face. Then she pulled back her arm, and the knife went flying through the air toward me. I ducked. I slid boneless under the table. I covered my head with my arms and tried to make myself disappear while the burly aides tackled and sedated her before carrying her back to her room. You'd think a nurse or two would have come by to make sure I was okay. But they were occupied with the other residents, who were screaming and panicking in the aftermath. I was still shaking when I got enough courage to poke my head out and crawl into my seat again. My father was not screaming or panicking. He was making his move.
"King me,"
he said, as if nothing at all had happened. It took me a while to realize that in his world, wherever that was,
nothing had happened, and that I couldn't be mad at him for not caring if I had been carved up like a Thanksgiving turkey by a psycho teenager. You can't blame someone if they honestly don't understand that their reality isn't the same as yours. Today, when I get to Hartwick House, my father isn't in the lounge. I find him sitting in his room in front of the window. In his hands is a bright rainbow of embroidery floss, twisted into knots. And not for the first time, I think that someone's enterprising idea of therapy is another person's frustrated hell. He glances up at me when I walk in, and he doesn't go ballistic, which is a good sign that today, he's not too agitated. I decide to use this to my advantage and broach the topic of my mother. I kneel in front of him, stilling his hands as they tug at the floss, tangling it even worse. "Dad," I say as I draw the orange thread through the loops of the other colors and drape it over his left knee. "What do you think would happen if we found her?" He doesn't answer me. I tug free the candy apple red thread. "I mean, what if she's the only reason we're broken?" I let my hands grasp his, where they are clasped around two more strands of floss. "Why did you let her go?" I whisper, holding his gaze. "Why didn't you ever tell the police she was missing?" My father had a breakdown, sure, but he's had moments of lucidity in the past 10 years. Maybe no one would have taken him seriously if he said my mother was lost. But then again, maybe they would have. Then maybe there would be a missing persons case to reopen. Then I wouldn't have to start from scratch, trying to get the police to investigate a disappearance that they didn't even know was a disappearance 10 years ago when it happened. Suddenly, the expression on my father's face changes. The frustration melts like foam where the ocean hits sand, and his eyes light up. They are the same color as mine, a too green that makes people uneasy. "Alice," he says, "do you know how to do this?" He lifts the handful of thread. "I'm not Alice," I tell him. He shakes his head, confused. I bite my lip, untangle the strands, and weave them to make a bracelet, a simple series of knots any day camper would know by heart. His hands flutter over mine like hummingbirds as I work. When I'm done, I unclip it from the safety pin that is fastened to his pants and tie it around his wrist, a bright bangle. My father admires it.
"You are always so good at this kind of thing,"
he says, smiling up at me. That's when I realize why my father did not report my mother as a missing person. Maybe she wasn't missing. Not to him. He's always been able to find her. In my face, and my voice, and my presence.
I wish it were that easy for me.
When I get home, my grandmother is watching Wheel of Fortune on television, calling out the answers before the contestants, and giving Vanna White fashion advice.
"That belt makes you look like a tramp,"
she tells Vanna, and then she sees me in the doorway.
"How did it go today?"
I falter a moment before realizing she's talking about babysitting, which of course I didn't really do.
"It was okay," I lie.
"There are stuffed shells in the fridge if you want to reheat them,"
she says, and her gaze flits back to the screen.
"Try an F, you stupid cow,"
she shouts. I take advantage of this distraction and run upstairs with Gertie at my heels. She makes herself a nest on my bed out of pillows and turns in circles to get comfortable. I don't know what to do. I've got information and nowhere to go with that. Reaching into my pocket, I take out the wad of bills I brought and peel one of the dollars off. I start folding it mindlessly, seamlessly into an elephant, but I keep screwing up and finally crumple it into a ball and throw it on the floor. I keep seeing my father's hands making angry knots in the embroidery floss. One of the original detectives who investigated the elephant sanctuary has Alzheimer's. The other is dead. But maybe it's not the end of the road. I'll just have to find a way to get the current detectives in the department to see that the department screwed up 10 years ago and should have considered my mother a missing person.
That should go over really well.
I turn on my laptop, and with a buzzy cord, it comes alive. I type in my password and open a search engine. Virgil Stanhope, I type. Death. The first article that pops up is a notice about the ceremony where he was going to be made detective. There is a picture of him, too. Sandy hair swept to the side, a big, fat, toothy grin, an Adam's apple that looks like the knob on a door. He looks goofy, young, but I guess 10 years ago that's just what he was. I open a new window, log into a public records database, which costs me $49.95 a year, FYI, and find the death notice of Virgil Stanhope. Tragically, it's dated the same day as his detective ceremony. I wonder if he got his badge and crashed in a car accident on the way home. Or worse, on the way there. A life interrupted. Well, I can relate to that. I click on the link, but it won't open. Instead, I get a page stating there's a server error. So I go back to my first search and rummage through the article descriptions until I find one that makes all the hair stand up on the back of my neck. Stanhope Investigations, I read. Find the future in the past. It's a crappy slogan, but I still click to open the page in a new window. Licensed. Domestic and Marital Relationship Investigations. Surveillance Services. Bail Recovery Agent. People Searches. Child Custody Investigations. Accidental Death Investigations. Missing Persons. There's another button at the top. About Us. Vic Stanhope is a licensed private investigator and former law enforcement officer and detective. He holds degrees in criminal justice and forensic science from the University of New Haven. He belongs to the International Association of Arson Investigators, the National Association of Bail Enforcement Agents, the National Association of Certified Investigators. It could be a coincidence, if not for the tiny thumbnail photograph of Mr. Stanhope. True, he looks older, and true, he has that buzz cut guys get when they're losing their hair, and they try to channel Bruce Willis to look super tough. Yet his Adam's apple is still front and center in the photo. Unmistakable. I suppose Vic and Virgil could be twins, but still. I grab my cell phone and punch in the number on the screen. 3 rings later, I hear someone grab the receiver on the other end. It sounds like it falls to the floor with a run of static and curses, and then is recovered.
What?
Is this Mr. Stanhope? I whisper.
Yeah.
The voice growls. Virgil Stanhope? There is a pause.
Not anymore.
The voice slurs, and he hangs up. My pulse is racing. Either Virgil Stanhope is back from the dead, or he never was dead. Maybe he just wanted people to think that so he could disappear. And if this is the case, he's the perfect person to find my mother.
Alice. Anyone who has ever seen elephants come across the bones of another individual would recognize the calling card of grief. The intense silence, the droop of the trunk and ears, the hesitant caresses, the sadness that seems to wrap the herd like a shroud when they encounter the remains of one of their own. But there's been some question as to whether elephants distinguish between the bones of elephants they knew well and those of elephants they did not. Some of the research that has been coming out from my colleagues at Amboseli up in Kenya, where they have more than 2,200 elephants that are recognized individually, has been intriguing. Taking one herd at a time, the researchers revealed several key items. A small bit of ivory, an elephant's skull, and a block of wood. They did this experiment as one would have in a lab, carefully maintaining the presentation of the objects and recording the responses of the elephants to see how long they lingered at each item. Without a doubt, the tiny piece of ivory was the most intriguing to the elephants, followed by the skull and then the wood. They stroked the ivory, picked it up, carried it, rolled it beneath their hind feet. Then the researchers presented the families with the skull of an elephant, the skull of a rhino, and the skull of a water buffalo. In this set of objects, the elephant skull was the item that interested the herd the most. Finally, the researchers focused on three herds that had, in the past few years, suffered the death of their leader. The families were presented with the skulls of those three matriarchs. You'd think that the elephants would have been most interested in the skull that belonged to the matriarch who had led their own herd. After all, the other parts of the controlled experiment clearly show that the elephants were capable of showing preference instead of randomly examining the items out of general curiosity. You'd think that, given the examples I had personally witnessed in Botswana of elephants who seemed deeply moved by the death of one of their own and capable of remembering that death years later, they would have paid tribute to their own leader. But that's not what happened. Instead, the Amboseli elephants were equally attracted to the three skulls. They may have known and lived with and even deeply mourned an individual elephant, but that behavior was not reflected in these results. Although the study proves that elephants are fascinated by the bones of other elephants, some might say it also proves that an elephant experiencing grief for an individual must be a fiction. Some might say if the elephants did not distinguish between the skulls, the fact that one of those skulls was their own mother wasn't important. But maybe it means that all mothers are.
Virgil. Every cop has one that got away. For some, it becomes the stuff of legend, the story they tell at every department Christmas bash, and when they have a few too many beers with the guys. It's the clue they didn't see that was right in front of their eyes. The file they couldn't bear to throw away. The case that was never closed. It's the nightmare they still have every now and then, from which they wake up sweaty and startled. For the rest of us, it's the nightmare we're still living. It's the face we see over our shoulder in the mirror. It's the person on the other end of the phone when we hear that mysterious dead air. It's always having someone with us, even when we're alone. It's knowing every second of every day that we failed. Donnie Boylan, the detective I was working with back then, told me once that his case was a domestic dispute call. He didn't slap cuffs on the husband because the guy was a reputable business owner everyone knew and liked. He figured a warning was enough. 3 hours after Donnie left the house, the guy's wife was dead. Single gunshot wound to the head. Her name was Amanda, and she was 6 months pregnant at the time. Donnie used to call her his ghost, the case that haunted him for years. My ghost is named Alice Metcalf. She didn't die like Amanda, as far as I know. She just disappeared, along with the truth about what happened 10 years ago. Sometimes when I wake up after a bender, I have to squint because I'm pretty sure Alice is on the other side of my desk, in the spot where clients sit when they are asking me to take pictures of their wives in the act of cheating or track down a deadbeat dad. I work alone, unless you count Jack Daniels as an employee. My office is the size of a closet and smells of takeout Chinese and rug cleaning fluid. I sleep on the couch here more often than I do at my apartment. But to my clients, I am Vic Stanhope, professional private investigator. Until I wake up with my head throbbing and a tongue too thick for my mouth, an empty bottle next to me, and Alice staring me down. Like hell you are, she says to me. This, Donnie Boylan said to me 10 years ago, as he popped another antacid tablet into his mouth. This couldn't have happened 2 weeks from now. Donnie was counting the days until his retirement. As I sat with him, he gave me a litany of all the things he did not need. Paperwork from the chief, red lights, a rookie like me to train, the heat wave that was aggravating his eczema. He also did not need a call at 7 a.m. from the New England Elephant Sanctuary reporting the death of one of their caregivers. The victim was a 44-year-old long-term employee. You have any idea what kind of shitstorm this is going to cause? He asked. You remember what it was like 3 years ago when the place opened? I did. I had just joined the force then. There were townspeople protesting the arrival of bad elephants, the ones who'd gotten kicked out of their zoos and circuses for acting out violently. Editorials every day chastised the planning board, which had allowed Thomas Metcalf to build his sanctuary, albeit with two concentric fences to keep the citizens safe from the animals. Or vice versa. Every day for the first 3 months of the sanctuary's existence, a few of us were sent over to keep the peace at the sanctuary gates, where the protests were centered. It turned out to be a non-issue. The animals adapted quietly, and the townspeople got used to having a sanctuary nearby, and there were no complications. Until that 7 a.m. phone call, anyway. We were waiting inside a small office. There were 7 shelves, each filled with binders labeled with the names of the elephants. Mara, Wanda, Syrah, Lily, Olive, Dion, Hester. There was a mess of papers on the desk, a stack of ledgers, 3 half-finished cups of coffee, and a paperweight shaped like a human heart. There were invoices for medication, and squash, and apples. I whistled, looking at the sum total of a bill for hay. Holy crap, I said. That could buy me a car. Donnie wasn't happy, but then Donnie was never happy. What's taking so goddamn long? He asked. We had been waiting now for almost 2 hours while the staff tried to corral the 7 elephants into the barn. Until then, our major crimes unit could not collect evidence inside the enclosure. You ever seen someone who's been trampled by an elephant? I asked. You ever shut up? Donnie replied. I was investigating a strange series of marks stretched along the wall, like hieroglyphs or something, when a man crashed into the office. He was skittish, nervous, his eyes frantic behind his glasses. I can't believe this happened, he said. This is a nightmare. Donnie stood up. You must be Thomas Metcalf. Yes, the man said, distracted. I'm sorry to keep you here so long. It's been crazy, trying to get the elephants secure. They're quite agitated. We've got 6 of them in the barn, and the 7th won't come close enough for us to entice her with food. But we've put up some temporary hot wires so that you can still get into the other side of the enclosure. He led us out of the small building into sunshine so bright the world looked overexposed. Do you have any idea how the victim might have gotten into the enclosure? Donnie asked. Metcalf blinked at him. Nevi? She's worked here since we opened. She's handled elephants for more than 20 years. She does our books. And she's also the night caregiver. He hesitated. Was. She was the night caregiver. Suddenly he stopped walking and covered his face with his hands. Oh, God. This is all my fault. Donnie looked at me. How so? He asked. Elephants can sense tension. They must have been agitated. By the caregiver? Before he could respond, there was suddenly a bellow so loud that I jumped. It came from somewhere on the other side of the fence. The leaves of the trees rustled. Isn't it a little far-fetched to think that an animal the size of an elephant could sneak up on someone? I asked. Metcalf turned. Have you ever seen an elephant stampede? When I shook my head, he smiled grimly. Hope that you never do. We led a crew of Major Crimes Unit investigators, walking for 5 minutes before we came to a small hill. As we crested it, I saw a man seated next to the body. He was a giant, with shoulders broad as a banquet table, strong enough to commit murder. His eyes were red-rimmed, puffy. He was black, and the victim was white. He was well over 6 feet tall, and certainly strong enough to overpower someone smaller. These were the sorts of things I noticed then as an apprentice detective. He was cradling the victim's head in his lap. The woman's skull had been crushed. Her shirt had been torn away from her, but for modesty, she was draped with a sweatshirt. Her left leg was bent at an impossible angle, and bruises mottled her skin. I walked a few feet away as the medical examiner crouched down to do his job. I didn't need a doc to tell me she was definitely dead. "This is Gideon Cartwright," Metcalf said. "He's the one who found his mother-in-law." He let his voice trail off. I couldn't peg the man's age, but it couldn't have been more than 10 years younger than the victim. Which meant the victim's daughter, his wife, had to be considerably younger than he was. "I'm Detective Boylan." Donnie knelt beside the man. "Were you here when this happened?"
"No. She was the night caregiver. She was out here alone last night," he said, his voice breaking. "It should have been me."
"You work here too?" Donnie asked. The MCU drones had blanketed the area like a swarm of bees. They were photographing the body and trying to limit the area of their investigation. The problem was, this was an outdoor crime scene with no solid boundaries. Who knew how far the woman had been chased by the elephant that ran her down? Who knew if there were any clues that could point to the moment of death? There was a deep hole about 20 yards away, and I could see human footprints on the edge. There may have been shreds of trace evidence caught in the trees, but mostly there were leaves and grass and dirt and elephant dung and flies and nature. God only knew how much of that was important to the crime scene and how much of it was business as usual. The medical examiner directed two of his agents to put the body in a bag and approached us.
"Let me guess," Donnie said. "Cause of death, trampling?"
"Well, there was certainly trampling, but I don't know if that was the cause of death. Skull split in half. Could have happened before the trampling or as a result of it." I realized too late that Gideon was listening to every word.
"No, no, no," Metcalf was suddenly shouting. "You can't put that there. It's a hazard for the elephants."
He pointed to the crime scene tape being staked out over a vast square by the MCU guys. Donnie squinted.
"The elephants aren't getting back in here anytime soon."
"I beg your pardon? I never said that you could take over the property. This is a natural, protected habitat,
and a woman was killed in it."
"It was an accident," Metcalf said. "I will not let you affect the daily routine of the elephants here."
"Unfortunately, Dr. Metcalf, you don't get to make that choice."
A muscle ticked in his jaw.
"How long will it take?"
I could see Donnie losing patience.
"I can't really say, but in the meantime, Lieutenant Stanhope and I will need to speak to everyone who interacts with the elephants."
"There are four of us. Gideon, Nevi, me, and Alice. My wife."
Those last words were directed right at Gideon.
"Where's Alice?" Donnie asked.
Metcalf stared at Gideon.
"I assumed she was with you."
His face was twisted with grief.
"I haven't seen her since last night."
"Well, neither have I."
The blood drained from Metcalf's face.
"If Alice is gone, who has my daughter?"
I am pretty certain that my current landlady, Abigail Chivers, is 200 years old, give or take a few months. Seriously, you'd think so too if you met her. I've never seen her wearing anything but a black dress with a brooch at her throat, her white hair scraped into a bun, and her pinched mouth shrinking even tighter whenever she pokes her head into my office and starts opening and slamming shut cabinets. She wraps her cane on the desk 6 inches from my head. "Victor," she says, "I can smell the work of the devil."
"Really?"
I lift my head off the desk and run my tongue over my teeth, which feel furry.
"All I can smell is cheap booze."
"I will not condone something illegal."
"Hasn't been illegal in a century, Abby," I sigh.
"We've had this fight dozens of times. Have I mentioned that in addition to being a teetotaler, Abigail is also apparently in the throes of dementia, and she is just as likely to call me President Lincoln as she is to call me Victor? Of course, this works to my advantage, too. Like when she tells me I'm late on the rent, and I lie and say I've already paid for the month. For an old gal, she's awfully spry. She whacks her cane on the cushions of the couch and even looks in the microwave.
"Where is it?"
"Where's what?" I ask, playing dumb.
"Satan's tears. Barley vinegar. Joy juice. I know you're hiding it somewhere."
I offer her my most innocent smile.
"Would I do something like that?"
"Victor," she says, "do not lie to me."
I cross my heart.
"Swear to God, there is no booze in this room."
I get to my feet and stagger to the tiny bathroom attached to my office space. It is big enough for a toilet, a sink, and a vacuum cleaner. I close the door behind me, take a piss, and then open the lid of the toilet tank. Fishing out the bottle I started last night, I take a long, healthy swig of whiskey, and just like that, the dull throb of my head starts to fade. I put the bottle back in its hiding place, flush, and open the door. Abby is still hovering. I haven't lied to her, just massaged the truth. It's what I was taught to do a lifetime ago, when I was training to be a detective.
"Now, where were we?"
I ask. And just then, the telephone rings.
"Drinking,"
she accuses.
"Abby, I'm shocked," I say smoothly. "I didn't think you indulged."
I steer her toward the door, the phone still ringing.
"How about we finish this later? Over a nightcap, maybe?"
I push her outside as she protests, then grab for the phone and fumble it.
"What?"
I snap into the receiver.
"Is this Mr. Stanhope?"
In spite of the quick swig of whiskey, my temples feel like they're in a vice again.
"Yeah?"
"Virgil Stanhope?"
When a year passed, and then two, and then five, I started to realize what Donnie had told me was true. Once a cop has a ghost, that ghost is there to stay. I couldn't get rid of Alice Metcalf. So instead, I got rid of Virgil Stanhope. I thought, stupidly, that if I started over, I could start fresh, free from guilt and questions. My dad had been a veteran, a small-town mayor, an all-around upstanding man. I borrowed his name, thinking some of his traits might rub off on me. I figured maybe I could become the kind of guy people trusted, instead of the one who'd fucked up royally. Until this moment, no one had questioned me.
"Not anymore," I mutter,
and I slam down the receiver. I stand in the middle of my office, pressing my hands to my aching head, but I can still hear her. I can hear her even when I go back into the bathroom and pull the bottle of whiskey out of the toilet tank again, even when I drink it down to its last drop. I never actually heard Alice Metcalf speak. She was unconscious when I found her, unconscious when I went to the hospital to see her. And then she was gone. But in my imagination, when she's sitting across from me passing judgment, she sounds exactly like the voice that was just on the other end of the phone. We had been sent to the sanctuary for a reported death that wasn't suspicious at the time of the initial call to the police. And in fact, there was no reason on that morning 10 years ago to assume that Alice Metcalf or her child was missing. They could have been out grocery shopping, blissfully unaware of the goings-on at the sanctuary. They could have been in the local park. Alice's cell phone had been called, but by Thomas's own admission, she never remembered to carry it anywhere. And the nature of her work, studying the cognition of elephants, meant that she often disappeared into the far reaches of the property for hours at a time to do observation, often, to her husband's chagrin, taking her 3-year-old with her. I was hoping she'd turn up with a cup of coffee, back from an early morning Dunkin' Donuts jaunt, the baby gumming a bagel. The last place I wanted them to be was in the sanctuary, with that 7th elephant still running loose. I didn't want to let myself think of what might have already happened to them. 4 hours into the investigation, MCU had collected 10 boxes of evidence. Husks of squash and tufts of dried grass, leaves black with what might have been dried dung and might have been dried blood. While they worked the scene, we accompanied Nevi's body to the main gate of the sanctuary with Gideon. He moved slowly. His voice was as hollow as a drum. As a cop, I'd seen enough tragedy to know he was either truly affected by the death of his mother-in-law, or else worthy of an Oscar. "My condolences," Donnie said. "I imagine this is very hard for you." Gideon nodded, wiping his eyes. He looked like a man who'd been through hell. "How long have you worked here?" Donnie asked.
"Since the sanctuary opened. And before that, with a circus down south. It's where I met my wife. Nevi was the one who got me my first job."
His voice broke on the dead woman's name.
"Have you ever seen elephants display aggressive behavior?"
"Have I seen it?" Gideon asked.
"Sure, at the circus. Here, not a lot. A swat if a keeper surprises them in a bad way. Once one of our girls freaked when she heard a cell phone ring that sounded like calliope music. You know how they say elephants never forget? Well, it's true, but not always in a good way. So it's possible that something upset one of the girls, and she knocked down your mother-in-law?"
Gideon looked at the ground.
"I guess."
"You don't sound very convinced," I said.
"Nevi knew her way around an elephant," Gideon said. "She wasn't some stupid rookie. This was just bad timing."
"What about Alice?" I asked.
"What about her?
Does she know her way around an elephant?"
"Alice knows elephants better than anyone I've ever met."
"Did you see her last night?" He looked at Donnie and then at me.
"Off the record," he said. "She came to me for help."
"Because the sanctuary was having problems?"
"No. Because of Thomas. When the sanctuary started hemorrhaging money, he changed. His mood swings, they're wild. He's been spending all his time locked in his study, and last night, he really scared Alice."
Scared. The word was a red flag. I got the sense he was holding something back. I wasn't surprised. He wouldn't talk out of turn about his boss's domestic troubles if he wanted to keep his job.
"Did she say anything else?" Donnie asked.
"She mentioned something about taking Janice somewhere so she'd be safe."
"Sounds like she trusts you," Donnie said. "How does that play out with your wife?"
"My wife is gone," Gideon answered. "Nevi is all the family I have... had left."
I stopped walking as we approached the massive barn. 5 elephants milled in the enclosure behind it, shifting beside each other like storm clouds, their quiet rumbles shaking the ground beneath our feet. I had the uncanny sense that they understood every single word we'd been saying. It made me think of Thomas Metcalf. Donnie faced Gideon.
"Is there anyone you can think of who'd want to hurt Nevi? Anyone human, that is?"
"Elephants. They're wild animals. They're not our pets. Anything could have happened."
Gideon reached a hand toward the metal bars of the fence as one of the elephants stuck her trunk through it. She sniffed at his fingers, then picked up a rock and chucked it at my head. Donnie laughed.
"Look at that, Verge. She doesn't like you."
"They need to be fed," Gideon slipped inside, and the elephants began to trumpet, knowing what was coming. Donnie shrugged and kept walking. I wondered if I was the only one who noticed that Gideon had not really answered his question.
"Go away, Abby,"
I shout. At least I think I'm shouting, because my tongue feels about 10 sizes too big for my mouth.
"I told you, I'm not drinking."
This is technically true. I'm not drinking. I'm drunk. But my landlady is still knocking. Or maybe that's a jackhammer. At any rate, it won't stop. So I haul myself up from the floor, where I guess I passed out, and yank open the door of my office. I'm having a hard time focusing, but the person in front of me definitely isn't Abby. She is only 5 feet tall, and she's wearing a backpack and a blue scarf around her neck that makes her look like Isadora Duncan or Frosty the Snowman or something.
"Mr. Stanhope?" she says. "Virgil Stanhope?"
Spread across Thomas Metcalf's desk were reams of paper covered with tiny symbols and numbers, like some kind of code. There was a diagram on it, too, one that looked like an octagonal spider made with jointed arms and legs. I'd practically failed the course in high school, but it looked like chemistry to me. As soon as we entered, Metcalf scrambled to roll the paper up. He was sweating, although it wasn't really all that hot outside.
"They're missing,"
he said, frantic.
"We're going to do everything in our power to find them."
"No, no.
My notes?"
I may not have been to a lot of crime scenes at that point in my career, but I still thought it was strange that a guy whose wife and kid were missing seemed to care less about them than about some pieces of paper. Donnie looked at the piles on the desk.
"Aren't they right there?"
"Obviously not," Metcalf snapped. "Obviously, I'm talking about the pages that aren't here."
The papers were some weird sequence of numbers and letters. It could have been a computer program. It could have been a satanic code. It was the same kind of writing I had seen earlier on the wall. Donnie glanced at me and raised his brow.
"Most guys would be pretty concerned about their missing family, considering that an elephant killed someone here last night."
Metcalf continued to sift through the stacks of paper and books, moving them from left to right as he cataloged them mentally.
"Which is why I've told her 1,000 times not to bring Jenna into the enclosures."
"Jenna?"
Donnie repeated.
"My daughter."
He hesitated.
"You and your wife have been fighting a lot, haven't you?"
"Who told you that?" he scoffed.
"Gideon. He said you upset Alice last night."
"I upset her?"
Thomas replied. I stepped forward, as Donnie and I had discussed. "Mind if I use the bathroom?" Metcalf waved me to a small room down the hall. Inside was a newspaper article, yellowed and curling in a broken frame, about the sanctuary. There was a picture of Thomas and a pregnant woman, smiling at the camera with an elephant lurking behind them. I opened the medicine cabinet and sorted through Band-Aids, Neosporin, Bactine, Advil. There were 3 prescription bottles, all recent refills, with Thomas's name on them. Prozac, Abilify, Zoloft. Antidepressants. If what Gideon said about the mood swings was true, it would make sense for Thomas to be on medication. I flushed the toilet for good measure, and by the time I came back into the office, Metcalf was pacing around the perimeter of the room like a caged tiger.
"I don't mean to tell you how to do your job, detective," he said. "But I'm the injured party, not the one who did the injuring. She ran off with my daughter and my life's work. Shouldn't you be looking for her instead of grilling me?"
I stepped forward. "Why would she steal your research?" He sank down in his desk chair.
"Because she's done it before. Multiple times. She's broken into my office to get my notes."
He unrolled the long scroll on his desk.
"This does not leave this room, gentlemen. But I am on the verge of a major breakthrough in the field of memory.
It's well established that memories are elastic before they're encoded by the amygdala,
but my research proves that each time the memory is recalled, it returns to that mutable state. That suggests memory loss can indeed happen after memory retrieval, if there's a pharmacological roadblock that disrupts protein synthesis in the amygdala. Imagine if you could erase traumatic memories with chemical agents years after the fact. It would completely change the way we treat post-traumatic stress.